myself, but quickly recovered. "It's all right," I said, though my heart was racing and the sweat on my face had gone suddenly cold. "It's only trapped gas. Dead bodies often make odd noises."
"Aye."
Jamie swallowed and nodded, steadying the lantern.
"Aye, I've seen it often. Takes you a bit by surprise, though, doesn't it?"
He smiled at me, lopsided, though a pale sheen of sweat gleamed on his forehead. "It does that." It occurred to me that he had doubtless dealt with a good many dead bodies, all unembalmed, and was likely at least as familiar with the phenomena of death as I was. I set a cautious hand in the same place, but no further noises resulted, and I resumed my examination. Another difference between this impromptu autopsy and the modern form was the lack of gloves. My hands were bloody to the wrists, and the organs and membranes had a faint but unpleasant feel of sliminess. Cold though it was in the shed, the inexorable process of decomposition had started. I got a hand under the heart and lifted it toward the light, checking for gross discolorations of the surface or visible ruptures of the great vessels.
"They move too, now and then," Jamie said after a minute.
There was an odd tone to his voice, and I glanced up at him, surprised. His eyes were fixed on Betty's face, but with a remote look that made it plain he was seeing something else. "Who moves?"
"Corpses."
Goose flesh rippled up my forearms. He was right, though I thought he might have kept that particular observation to himself for the moment. "Yes," I said, as casually as possible, looking back at my work. "Common post-mortem phenomena, usually just the movement of gases."
"I saw a dead man sit up once," he said,
his tone as casual as my own. "What? At a wake? He wasn't really dead?"
"No, in a fire. And he was dead enough."
I glanced up sharply. His voice was flat and matter-of-fact, but his face bore an inward look of deep abstraction. Whatever he'd seen, he was seeing it again.
"After Culloden, the English burned the Highland dead on the field. We smelled the fires, but I didn't see one, save when they took me out and put me in the wagon to send me home."
He had lain hidden under a layer of hay, nose pressed to a crack in the boards in order to breathe. The wagon driver had taken a circuitous route off the field to avoid any questions from troops near the farmhouse, and at one point had stopped for a moment to wait for a group of soldiers to move away.
"There was a fresh pyre burning, perhaps 10 yards away. They'd set it alight no more than a short time before, for the clothes had only just begun to char. I saw Graham Gillespie lying on the heap near me, and he was surely dead, for there was the mark of a pistol shot on his temple."
The wagon had waited for what seemed a long time, though it was hard to tell through the haze of pain and fever. But as he watched, he had seen Gillespie suddenly sit up amid the flames and turn his head.
"He was looking straight at me," he said. "Had I been in my right mind, I expect I would have let out a rare skellach. As it was, it only seemed friendly of Graham."
There was a hint of uneasy amusement in his voice.
"I thought he was perhaps telling me it wasn't so bad being dead. That, or welcoming me to hell, maybe."
"Post-mortem contracture," I said, absorbed in the excavation of the digestive system. "Fire makes the muscles contract and the limbs often twist into very lifelike positions. Can you bring the light closer?" I had the esophagus pulled free and carefully slit the length of it, turning back the flabby tissue. There was some irritation toward the lower end, and there was blood in it, but no sign of rupture or hemorrhage. I bent, squinting into the pharyngeal cavity, but it was too dark to see much there. I was in no way equipped for detailed exploration, so instead returned my examinations to the other end, slipping a hand under the stomach and lifting it up. I felt a sharpening of the sense of wrongness that I had had through this whole affair. If there was something amiss, this was the most likely place to find evidence of it.
Logic, as well as sixth sense, said as much. There was no food in the stomach. After such vomiting, that was hardly surprising. When I cut through the heavy muscular wall, though, the sharp scent of ipecac cut through the reek of the body.
What?
Jamie leaned forward at my exclamation, frowning at the body. Ipecac. That quack dosed her with ipecac, and recently. Can you smell it? He grimaced with distaste, but took a cautious sniff and nodded.
Would that not be a proper thing to do when you've a person wi' a curdled wheem? You gave wee Becky MacLeod ipecacuanha yourself when she'd drunk your blue stuff.
True enough. 5-year-old Becky had drunk half a bottle of the arsenic decoction I made to poison rats, attracted by the pale blue colour and evidently not at all put off by the taste. Well, the rats liked it too. But I did that right away. There's no point in giving it hours afterward when the poison or irritant has already passed out of the stomach. Given Fentiman's state of medical knowledge, though, would he have known that? He might simply have administered ipecac again because he could think of nothing else to do. I frowned, turning back the heavy wall of the stomach. Yes, this was the source of the hemorrhage. The inner wall was raw-looking, dark red as ground meat. There was a small amount of liquid in the stomach, clear lymph that had begun to separate from the clotted blood left in the body.
So you're thinking that it was maybe the ipecac that killed her?
I was. But now I'm not so sure, I murmured, probing carefully. It had occurred to me that if Fentiman had given Betty a heavy dose of ipecac, the violent vomiting provoked by it might have caused an internal rupture and hemorrhage. But I wasn't finding any evidence of that. I used the scalpel to slit the stomach further open, pulling back the edges and opening the duodenum. Can you hand me one of the small empty jars? And the wash bottle, please. Jamie hung the lantern on the nail and obligingly knelt to rummage through the bag while I rummaged further through the stomach. There was some granular material forming a pale sludge in the furrows of the rugi. I scraped gingerly at it, finding that it came free easily, a thick, gritty paste between my fingertips. I wasn't sure what it was, but a suspicion was growing unpleasantly in the back of my mind. I meant to flush the stomach, collect the residue, and take it back to the house where I could examine it in a decent light come morning. If it was what I thought... Without warning, the door of the shed swung open. A whoosh of cold air made the flame of the lantern burn suddenly high and bright. Bright enough to show me Philip Wiley's face, pale and shocked in the frame of the doorway. He stared at me, his mouth hanging slightly open, then closed it and swallowed. I heard the sound of it clearly. His eyes travelled slowly over the scene, then returned to my face, wide pools of horror. I was shocked too. My heart had leapt into my throat and my hands had frozen, but my brain was racing. What would happen if he caused an outcry? It would be the most dreadful scandal, whether I was able to explain what I was doing or not. If not... Fear rippled over me in a chilly wave. I had come close to being burned for witchcraft once before, and that was one time too often. I felt a slight movement of the air near my feet, and realised that Jamie was crouched in the deep shadow below the table. The light of the lantern was bright, but limited. I stood in a pool of darkness that reached to my waist. Wiley hadn't seen him. I reached out a toe and nudged him, as a signal to stay put. I forced myself to smile at Philip Wiley, though my heart was stuck firmly in my throat and beating wildly. I swallowed hard and said the first thing that came into my mind, which happened to be... Good evening. He licked his lips. He was wearing neither patch nor powder at the moment, but was quite as pale as the muslin sheet.
Mrs. Fraser, he said,
and swallowed again.
What are you doing?
I should have thought that was reasonably obvious. Presumably his question had to do with the reasons why I was doing it, and I had no intention of going into those.
Never you mind that. I said crisply, recovering a bit of nerve. What are you doing, skulking round the place at dead of night?
Evidently, that was a good question.
His face shifted at once from open horror to wariness. His head twitched as though to turn and look over his shoulder. He stopped the motion before it was completed, but my eyes followed the direction of it. There was a man standing in the darkness behind him, a tall man who now stepped forward, his face glimmering pale in the glow of the lantern, sardonic eyes the green of gooseberries. Stephen Bonnet.
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said.
A number of things happened at that point. Jamie came out from under the table with a rush like a striking cobra. Philip Wiley leapt back from the door with a startled cry, and the lantern crashed from its nail to the floor. There was a strong smell of splattered oil and brandy, a soft whoosh like a furnace lighting, and the crumpled shroud was burning at my feet. Jamie was gone. There were shouts in the darkness outside and the sound of running feet on brick. I kicked at the burning fabric, meaning to stamp it out. Then I thought better, and instead lunged against the table, knocking it over and dumping its contents. I seized the blazing shroud with one hand and dragged it over corpse and upturned table. The floor of the shed was thick with sawdust, already burning in spots. I kicked the shattered lantern hard, knocking it into the dry boards of the wall and spilling out the rest of its oil, which ignited at once. There were shouts from the kitchen garden, voices calling in alarm. I had to get out. I seized my bag and fled, red-handed, into the night, my fist still clenched tight about the evidence. It was the one point of certainty in the prevailing chaos. I had no notion what was going on or what might happen next, but at least I knew for sure that I was right. Betty had indeed been murdered. There were a pair of agitated servants in the kitchen garden, apparently wakened by the disturbance. They were casting round in a haphazard manner, calling out to each other, but with no light but that of the fading moon, it was an easy matter to keep to the shadows and slip past them. No one had come out of the main house yet, but the shouts and flames were going to attract attention soon. I crouched against the wall in the shadows of a huge raspberry cane as the gate flung open and two more slaves came rushing through from the stable, half-dressed and incoherent, shouting something about the horses. The smell of burning was strong in the air. No doubt they thought the stable was on fire, or about to be. My heart was pounding so hard against the inside of my chest that I could feel it like a fist. I had an unpleasant vision of the flaccid heart I just held in my hand, and of what my own must look like now, a dark red knob of slick muscle pulsing and thumping, battering mindlessly away in its neatly socketed cave between the lungs. The lungs weren't working nearly so well as the heart. My breath came short and hard, in gasps that I tried to stifle for fear of detection. What if they dragged Betty's desecrated body from the shed? They wouldn't know who'd been responsible for the mutilation, but the discovery would cause the most fearful outcry, with resultant wild rumours and public hysteria. A glow was visible now above the far wall of the kitchen garden. The roof of the shed was beginning to burn, fire glow showing in brilliant thin lines as the pine shingles began to smoke and curl. Sweat was prickling behind my ears, but my breath came a little easier when I saw the slaves standing by the far gate in a knot, bunched together in awed silhouette. Of course, they wouldn't try to put it out, well caught as it was. The nearest water was in the horse troughs. By the time buckets were fetched, the shed would be well on its way to ashes. There was nothing near it that would burn. Best to let it go. Smoke purled up in quickening billows high into the air. Knowing what was in the shed, it was much too easy to imagine spectral shapes in the transparent undulations. Then the fire broke through the roof, and tongues of flame lit the smoke from below in an eerie, beautiful glow. A high-pitched wail broke from behind me, and I started back, banging my elbow against the brick wall. Phedre had come through the gate, Gussie and another female slave behind her. She ran through the garden, screaming, "Mama!" as her white shift caught the light of flames that now burst through holes in the shed's roof, showering sparks. The men by the gate caught her. The women hurried after, reaching for her, calling out in agitation. I tasted blood in my mouth and realised that I'd bitten my lower lip. I closed my eyes convulsively, trying not to hear Fred's frantic cries and the antiphonal babble of her comforters. A frightful sense of guilt washed over me. Her voice was so like Bree's, and I could imagine so clearly what Bree might feel were it my own body burning in that shed. But there were worse things Fred might feel had I not let loose the fire. My hands were shaking from cold and tension, but I groped for my bag, which I dropped on the ground at my feet. My hands felt stiff and dreadful, gummy with drying blood and lymph. I mustn't be found this way. I fumbled in the sack with my free hand, finally coming up by feel with a lidded jar normally used to keep leeches and the small wash bottle of dilute alcohol and water. I couldn't see, but felt blood crack and flake away as I opened my cramped fingers and gingerly scraped the contents of my hand into the jar. I couldn't grip the cork of the bottle with my shaking fingers. Finally, I pulled it out with my teeth and poured the alcohol over my open palm, washing the rest of the grainy residue into the jar. The house had been roused now. I could hear voices coming from that direction. What was going on? Where was Jamie? And where were Bonnet and Philip Wiley? Jamie hadn't been armed with anything save a bottle of holy water. Were either of the others? I had heard no shots, at least. But blades made no noise. I rinsed both hands hastily with the rest of the wash bottle and dried them on the dark lining of my cloak where the smears wouldn't show. People were running back and forth through the garden, shadows flitting along the walkways like phantoms, mere feet from my hiding place. Why did they make no noise? Were they truly people, or shades somehow roused by my sacrilege? Then one figure shouted, another replied. I realised dimly that the running people made no sound on the bricks because they were barefoot, and because my ears were ringing. My face was tingling with cold sweat, my hands far more numb than chill would account for. You idiot, Beecham, I thought to myself. You're going to faint. Sit down. I must have managed to do so, for I came to myself a few moments later, sprawled in the dirt under the raspberry canes, half leaning against the wall. The kitchen garden seemed full of people by now. Jostling pale shapes of guests and servants, indistinguishable as ghosts in their shifts. I waited for the space of a few breaths to be sure I was recovered, then lurched awkwardly to my feet and stepped out onto the dark path, bag in hand. The first person I saw was Major MacDonald, standing on the path, watching the shed burn, his white wig gleaming in the light from the fire. I gripped him by the arm, startling him badly. "What's happening?" I said, not bothering to apologise.
"Where's your husband?"
he said in the same moment, peering round me in search of Jamie. "I don't know," I said, all too truthfully. "I'm looking for him."
"Mrs. Fraser, are you all right, dear lady?"
Lloyd Stanhope popped up by my elbow, looking like a very animated boiled egg in his nightshirt, his polled head startlingly round and pale without his wig. I assured him that I was quite all right, which I was by now. It wasn't until I saw Stanhope and noticed that most of the other gentlemen present were in a similar state of déshabille that I realised the Major was fully clothed, from wig to buckled shoes. My face must have changed as I looked at him, for I saw his brows raise and his gaze run from my bound hair to my shod feet, as he quite obviously noticed the same thing about me. "I heard shouts of fire and thought someone might be hurt," I said coolly, lifting the bag. "I brought my medical kit. Is everyone all right, do you know?" "So far as I..." MacDonald began, but then sprang back in alarm, grasping my arm and dragging me back too. The roof gave way with a deep sighing noise, and sparks plumed high, showering down among the crowd in the garden. Everyone gasped and cried out, falling back. Then there came one of those brief, inexplicable pauses when everyone in a crowd falls suddenly silent at once. The fire was still burning, with a noise like crumpling paper, but over it I could hear a distant shouting. It was a woman's voice, high and cracked, but strong for all that, and full of fury.
"Mrs. Cameron!"
Stanhope exclaimed. But the Major was already making for the house at a run. Chapter 53. The Frenchman's Gold. We found Jocasta Cameron Innes on the window seat in her room, clad in her chemise, bound hand and foot with strips of bed linen, and absolutely scarlet-faced with fury. I had no time to take further note of her condition, for Duncan Innes, clad for the night in nothing but his shirt, was lying sprawled on his face on the floor near the hearth. I rushed over and knelt by him at once, searching for a pulse.
"Is he dead?"
The Major peered over my shoulder, evidencing more curiosity than sympathy. "No," I said briefly. "Get these people out of here, will you?" The chamber was crammed with guests and servants, all exclaiming over the newly freed Jocasta, expostulating, speculating, and generally making bloody nuisances of themselves. The Major blinked at my peremptory tone, but retired to deal with the situation. Duncan was certainly alive, and a cursory examination showed me no injury beyond a large lump behind one ear. Evidently, he had been clubbed with the heavy silver candlestick which lay beside him on the floor. He had a nasty colour, but his pulse was fairly good, and he was breathing evenly. I thumbed open his eyelids, one at a time, and bent close to check his pupils. They stared back at me, glazed, but the same size and not abnormally dilated. So far, so good. Behind me, the Major was making good use of his military experience, barking orders in a parade ground voice. Since most of those present weren't soldiers, this was having a limited effect. Jocasta Cameron was having a much greater one. Released from her bonds, she staggered across the room, leaning heavily on Ulysses' arm, parting the crowd like the waves of the Red Sea. "Duncan, where is my husband?" she demanded, turning her head from side to side, blind eyes fierce. People gave way before her, and she reached my side in seconds. "Who is there?" Her hands swept in a flat arc before her, searching for position. "It's me, Claire." I reached up to touch her hand, guiding her down beside me. Her own fingers were chilled and trembling, and there were deep red marks on her wrists from the bonds. "Don't worry. I think Duncan will be all right." She put out a hand, seeking to see for herself, and I guided her fingers to his throat, setting them on the big vein I could see pulsing at the side of his neck. She uttered a small exclamation and leaned forward, putting both hands on his face, tracing his features with an anxious tenderness that quite moved me, so at odds as it was with her normal autocratic mien. "They struck him. Is he badly hurt?" "I think not," I assured her. "Only a knock on the head."
"Are you quite sure?"
Her face turned toward me, frowning, and her sensitive nostrils flared.
"I smell blood."
With a small shock, I realized that while my hands were mostly clean, my fingernails were still heavily ringed with dark blood from the impromptu autopsy. I repressed the urge to curl my hands, instead murmuring discreetly, "That's me, I expect. My courses." Major MacDonald was glancing curiously in our direction. Had he heard her? There was a stir at the doorway, and I turned. To my immense relief, it was Jamie. He was dishevelled, his coat was torn, and he sported what looked like the beginnings of a black eye, but otherwise appeared undamaged. My relief must have shown on my face, for his grim look softened a little, and he nodded as he met my eye. Then it hardened again as he saw Duncan. He dropped to one knee beside me. "He's all right," I said, before he could ask. "Someone hit him on the head and tied up your aunt."
"Aye? Who?"
He glanced up at Jocasta and laid a hand on Duncan's chest, as though to reassure himself that Duncan was indeed still breathing.
"I have not the slightest notion," she replied crisply. "If I had, I should have sent men to hunt the ill deedy sharks down by now."
Her lips tightened into a thin line, and the high colour surged back into her face at thought of the assailants.
"Did no one see the rascals?"
"I think not, aunt," Jamie replied calmly. "With such a boiling in the house, no one kens what to look for, aye?"
I raised one eyebrow at him in silent question. What did he mean by that? Had Bonnet got away? For surely it must have been Bonnet who had invaded Jocasta's chamber. Boiling or no, there couldn't be multiple violent criminals at large on the same night in a place the size of River Run. Jamie shook his head briefly. He glanced at my hands, saw the blood under my nails, and raised an eyebrow of his own. Had I discovered anything? Had there been time for me to be sure? I nodded, and a slight shudder went over me. Yes, I knew. Murder, I mouthed to him. He squeezed my arm in quick reassurance and glanced over his shoulder. The Major had at last succeeded in pushing most of the crowd out into the hallway, sending the servants for restoratives and refreshments, a groom for the sheriff in Cross Creek, the men out to search the grounds for possible miscreants, and the ladies down to the salon in a flutter of excited puzzlement. The Major closed the door firmly behind them, then came briskly over to us.
"Shall we get him onto the bed, then?"
Duncan was beginning to stir and groan. He coughed and gagged a little, but fortunately didn't throw up. Jamie and Major MacDonald got him up, limp arms about their shoulders, and conveyed him to the big four-poster, where they laid him down with complete disregard for the quilted silk coverlet. With a faint atavistic sense of housewifeliness, I tucked a soft green velvet pillow under his head. It was filled with bran, but crackled faintly under my hand and gave off a strong scent of lavender. Lavender was good for headache, all right, but I wasn't sure it was quite up to this.
"Where is Fed?"
Ulysses had guided Jocasta to her chair, and she sank back in its leather depths, looking suddenly exhausted and old. The colour had left her face along with her rage, and her white hair was coming down in struggles round her shoulders. "I sent Fed to bed, auntie." Bree had come in, unnoticed in the scrum, and had resisted removal by the Major. She bent over Jocasta, touching her hand with solicitude. "Don't worry. I'll take care of you." Jocasta put her own hand over Bree's in gratitude, but sat up straighter, looking puzzled.
"Sent her to bed? Why? And what in God's name is burning?"
She jerked bolt upright, alarmed. "Are the stables afire?" The wind had changed, and the night air was streaming in through a broken pane above the window seat, heavy with the scent of smoke and a faint, dreadful smell of burned flesh.
"No, no. The stables are fine. Fedra was upset," Bree explained with some delicacy. "The shed by the kitchen garden seemed to have burned down. Her mother's body?"
Jocasta's face went quite blank for a moment. Then she drew herself up, and an extraordinary look came into her face. Something almost like satisfaction, though with a tinge of puzzlement. Jamie was standing behind me. He evidently saw it too, for I heard him give a soft grunt.
"Are you somewhat recovered, aunt?" he asked.
She turned her face toward him, one eyebrow lifted in sardonic reply.
"I shall be the better for a dram," she said, accepting the cup that Ulysses set deftly into her hands. "But I, nephew, am well enough.
Duncan, though." I was sitting by Duncan on the bed, his wrist in my hand, and could feel him coming toward the surface of consciousness, eyelids fluttering and fingers twitching slightly against my palm.
"He's coming round," I assured her. "Give him brandy, Ulysses," Jocasta commanded, but I stopped the butler with a shake of my head. "Not quite yet. He'll choke."
"Do you feel yourself equal to telling us what happened, aunt?"
Jamie asked, with a noticeable edge to his voice.
"Or must we wait for Duncan to come to himself?"
Jocasta sighed, closing her eyes briefly.
She was as good as all the Mackenzies at hiding what she thought. But in this case it was evident, at least, that she was thinking, and furiously at that.
The tip of her tongue flicked out, touching a raw spot at the corner of her mouth, and I realised that she must have been gagged as well as bound. I could feel Jamie behind me seething with some strong feeling. Near as he was, I could hear his stiff fingers drumming softly on the bedpost. Much as I wanted to hear Jocasta's story, I wanted even more to be alone with Jamie, to tell him what I had discovered, and to find out what had happened in the darkness of the kitchen garden. Outside, voices murmured in the hall. Not all the guests had dispersed. I caught muffled phrases.
Quite burnt up. Nothing left but the bones. Stolen? Don't know. Check the stables. Yes, completely burned.
A deep shiver struck me, and I gripped Duncan's hand hard, fighting a panic that I didn't understand. I must have looked odd, for Bree said softly, "Mama?" She was looking at me, brow creased with worry. I tried to smile at her, but my lips felt stiff. Jamie's hands settled on my shoulders, large and warm. I'd been holding my breath without realizing it. At his touch, I let it out in a small gasp and breathed again. Major MacDonald glanced curiously at me, but his attention was at once deflected by Jocasta, who opened her eyes and turned her face in his direction.
"It is Major MacDonald, is it not?" "At your service, Mum."
The Major made an automatic bow, forgetting, as folk often did, that she couldn't see him.
"I thank you for your gallant service, Major. My husband and I are most indebted to you."
The Major made a politely dismissive sound.
"No, no," she insisted, straightening up and brushing back her hair with one hand. "You've been put to great trouble on our account, and we must not impose further on your kindness. Ulysses, take the Major down to the parlour and find him proper refreshment."
The butler bowed obsequiously. I noticed for the first time that he was dressed in a nightshirt over unbuckled breeches, though he had clapped his wig on his head, and ushered the Major firmly toward the door. MacDonald looked ludicrously surprised and not a little disgruntled at being given the push in this civilized fashion, he having quite obviously intended to stay and hear all the gory details. Still, there was no graceful way of resisting, and he made the best of it, bowing in a dignified manner as he took his leave. The panic had begun to recede as bafflingly as it had come. Jamie's hands radiated a warmth that seemed to spread through my body, and my breath came easily again. I was able to focus my attention on my patient, who had got his eyes open, though he seemed to be regretting it.
"Oh, Mochian."
Duncan squinted against the glow of the lamp, focusing with some difficulty on my face, then rising to Jamie's behind me.
"MacDo, what's come amiss?"
One of Jamie's hands left my shoulder and reached down to tighten on Duncan's arm.
"Then afash yourself a harish."
He glanced meaningfully at Jocasta.
"Your wife is just about to tell us what has happened. Are you not, aunt?"
There was a slight but definite emphasis on the "not," and Jocasta, thus put on the spot, pursed her lips, but then sighed and sat straight, plainly resigned to the unpleasant necessity of confidence.
"There is no one here but family."
Being assured that there was not, she nodded and began. She had sent away her maid and been on the point of retiring, she said, when the door from the hall had suddenly opened to admit what she thought were two men.
"I am sure there was more than one. I heard their footsteps and breathing," she said, frowning in concentration. "There might have been three, but I think not. Only one of them spoke, though. I think the other must have been someone I ken, for he stayed far away, quite at the end of the room, as though he were afraid I should recognise him by some means."
The man who had spoken to her was a stranger. She was positive that she'd never heard his voice before.
"He was an Irishman," she said,
and Jamie's hand tightened abruptly on my shoulder.
"Well enough spoken, but not a gentleman by any means."
Her nostrils flared a little with unconscious disdain.
"No, hardly that," Jamie said under his breath.
Bree had started slightly at the word Irishman, though her face bore no more than a slight frown of concentration as she listened. The Irishman had been polite, but blunt in his demands. He wanted the gold.
"Gold?"
It was Duncan who spoke, but the question was plain on everyone's face.
What gold? We've no money in the house save a few pounds sterling and a bit of the proclamation money.
Jocasta's lips pressed tight. There was no help for it, though. Not now. She made a small growling noise in her throat, an inarticulate protest at being compelled to give up the secret she had kept for so long.
"The Frenchman's gold," she said abruptly.
"What?" said Duncan in bewilderment.
He touched the lump behind his ear gingerly, as though convinced it had affected his hearing.
"The French gold," Jocasta repeated rather irritably. "That was sent just before Culloden."
"Before?" Bree began, wide-eyed, but Jamie interrupted her.
"Louis's gold," he said softly. "That's what you mean, Aunt. The Stuart's gold."
Jocasta uttered a short laugh, quite without humour.
"Once it was."
She paused, listening. The voices had moved away from the door, though there were still noises in the hallway. She turned toward Bree and motioned toward the door.
"Go and see that no one's got his lug to the keyhole, lass. I haven't held my peace these 25 years only to spill it to the whole world."
Bree opened the door briefly, peered out, then closed it, reporting that no one was near.
"Good. Come ye here, lass. Sit by me. But no. First, fetch me the case I showed you yesterday."
Looking more than puzzled, Bree vanished into the dressing room, returning with a slender case of worn black leather. She laid it in Jocasta's lap and settled onto a stool beside her aunt, giving me a look of faint concern. I was feeling quite myself again, though a faint echo of that odd fear still rang in my bones. I nodded reassuringly to Bree, though, and bent to give Duncan a sip of watered brandy. I knew what it was now, that ancient distress. It was that phrase overheard, the words by chance the same that a small girl had once heard spoken, whispered in the next room by strangers who had come to say her mother wouldn't be coming back, that she had died. An accident. A crash. Fire.
"Burnt to bones," the voice had said,
filled with the awe of it.
"Burnt to bones."
And the desolation of a daughter forever abandoned. My hand trembled, and the cloudy liquid ran in a trickle down Duncan's chin.
"But that was long ago,
and in another country," I thought, steeling myself against the riptide of memory. "And besides..." Jocasta drained her own cup, set it down with a small thump, and opened the case in her lap. A gleam of gold and diamond showed inside, and she lifted out a slender wooden rod that held 3 rings.
"I had 3 daughters once," she said. 3 girls. Clementina, Shonak, and Morna."
She touched one of the rings, a wide band set with 3 large diamonds.
"This was for my girls. Hector gave it to me when Morna was born. She was his, Morna. You know it means beloved."
Her other hand left the box and stretched out, groping. She touched Bree's cheek, and Bree took the hand, cradling it between her own.
"I had 1 living child of each marriage."
Jocasta's long fingers probed delicately, touching each ring in turn.
"Clementina belonged to John Cameron.
Him I wed when I myself was little more than a child. I bore her at 16. Shonak was the daughter of Black Hugh. She was dark like her sire, but she had my brother Colum's eyes." She turned her own blind eyes toward Jamie, briefly, then bent her head back, touching the ring with 3 diamonds again.
"And then Morna, my last child. She was but 16 when she died."
The old woman's face was bleak, but the line of her mouth softened, speaking the names of her vanished girls.
"I'm sorry, Aunt."
Bree spoke softly. She bent her head to kiss the knuckles of the hand she cradled, knobbed with age. Jocasta tightened her hand a little in acknowledgement, but didn't mean to be distracted from her story.
"Hector Cameron gave me this," Jocasta said, touching the ring.
and he killed them all. My children, my daughters. He killed them for the Frenchman's gold.
The shock of it took my breath and hollowed my stomach. I felt Jamie go still behind me and saw Duncan's bloodshot eyes go wide. Brianna didn't change expression. She closed her eyes for a moment, but still held on to the long, bony hand.
"What happened to them, Aunt?" she said quietly. "Tell me."
Jocasta was silent for a few moments. So was the room. There was no sound save the hiss of beeswax burning and the faint asthmatic wheeze of her breath. To my surprise, when she spoke again, it wasn't to Brianna. Instead, she lifted her head and turned again toward Jamie.
"You know about the golden, Avish Monferre," she said.
If he found this a strange question, he gave no sign of it, but answered calmly.
"I have heard something of it," he said.
He moved, coming round the bed to sit beside me, closer to his aunt.
"It has been a rumour in the Highlands ever since Cologne. Louis would send gold, they said, to help his cousin in his holy fight. And then they said the gold had come, yet no man saw it." "I saw it."
Jocasta's wide mouth, so like her nephew's, widened further in a sudden grimace, then relaxed.
"I saw it," she repeated. £30,000 in gold bullion. I was with them the night it came ashore, rowed in from the French ship. It was in 6 small chests, each one so heavy that only 2 at a time could be brought, else the boat would sink. Each chest had the fleur-de-lis carved on the lid, each one bound with iron bands and a lock, each lock itself sealed with red wax, and the wax bore the print of King Louis's ring, the fleur-de-lis.
A sigh ran through us all at the words, a collective breath of awe. Jocasta nodded slowly, blind eyes open to the sights of that night long past.
"Where was it brought ashore, Aunt?" Jamie asked softly.
She nodded slowly, as though to herself, eyes fixed on the scene her memory painted.
"On Innismarich," she said. "A tiny isle, just off Coigach."
I'd been holding my breath. Now I let it out slowly and met Jamie's eyes. Innismarich, island of the sea people. The Silkies Isle, it meant. We knew that place.
"There were the 3 men trusted with it," she said. "Hector was one. My brother Dougal was another. The 3rd man was masked. They all were. But of course I kent Hector and Dougal. I didn't ken the 3rd man, nor did any of them speak his name. I knew his servant, though, a man named Duncan Kerr."
Jamie had stiffened slightly at Dougal's name. At the name of Duncan Kerr, he froze.
"There were servants, too?" he asked.
"2, she said, and a faint, bitter smile twisted her mouth.
"The masked man brought Duncan Kerr, as I said, and my brother Dougal had a man with him from Leoch. I kent his face, but not his name. Hector had me to help him. I was a braw, strong woman, like you, Alannon, like you," she said softly, squeezing Brianna's hand. "I was strong, and Hector trusted me as he could trust no other. I trusted him, too. Then..."
The noises from outside had died away, but a breeze through the broken pane stirred the curtains, uneasy as a ghost that hears its name called from a distance.
"There were 3 boats. The chests were small, but heavy enough that it took 2 persons to carry one between them. We took 2 chests into our boat, Hector and I, and we rowed away into the fog. I could hear the splash of the others' oars growing fainter as they drew away and then lost in the night."
"When was this, Aunt?"
Jamie asked, his eyes intent on her.
"When did the gold come from France?"
"Too late," she whispered. "Much too late. Damn Louis," she exclaimed with a sudden fierceness that brought her upright in her seat. "Damn the wicked Frenchman, and may his eyes rot as mine have.
To think what might have been had he been true to his blood and his word.
Jamie's eyes met mine sidelong.
Too late. Had the gold come sooner, when Charles landed at Glenfinnan, perhaps, or when he took Edinburgh, and for a few brief weeks held the city as a king returned. What then?
The ghost of a smile touched Jamie's lips with ruefulness, and he glanced at Brianna, then back at me, the question asked and answered in his eyes.
What then? It was March, Jocasta said, recovering from her outburst. A freezing night, but clear as ice. I stood upon the cliff and looked far out to sea, and the path of the moon lay like gold on the water. The ship came sailing in upon that golden path like a king to his coronation, and I did think it a sign.
Her head turned toward Jamie, and her mouth twisted abruptly.
I did think I heard him laughing then, she said. Black Brian, him who took my sister from me. It would have been like him, but he was not there. I suppose it was only the barking of the silkies.
I was watching Jamie as she spoke. He didn't move, but like magic the reddish hairs on his forearm rose, glinting like wires in the candlelight.
"I didn't ken you knew my father," he said,
a faint edge to his voice.
"But let that be for now, aunt. It was March, you see."
She nodded.
"Too late," she repeated. "It was meant to have come 2 months before," Hector said. "There were delays."
It had been too late.
In January, after the victory at Falkirk, such a show of support from France might have been decisive.
But in March, the Highland army was already moving north, turned back at Derby from its invasion of England. The last slim chance of victory had been lost, and Charles Stuart's men were marching then toward destruction at Culloden. With the chests safe ashore, the new guardians of the gold had conferred over what to do with the treasure. The army was moving, and Stuart with it. Edinburgh was once more in the hands of the English. There was no safe place to take it, no trustworthy hands into which it could be delivered.
"They didn't trust O'Sullivan or the others near the prince," Jocasta explained. "Irishmen, Italians. Dougal said they hadn't gone to so much trouble only to have the gold squandered or stolen by foreigners."
She smiled, a little grimly.
"He meant he didn't want to chance losing the credit for having got it."
The three keepers had been no more willing to trust one another than the prince's advisers. Most of the night had been spent in argument in the bleak upper room of a desolate tavern, while Jocasta and the two servants slept on the floor among the red-sealed chests. Finally, the gold had been divided. Each man had taken two of the chests, swearing on his blood to keep the secret and hold the treasure faithfully in trust for his rightful monarch, King James.
"They made the two servants swear as well," Jocasta said. "They cut each man, and the drops of blood shone redder in the candlelight than the wax seals on the chests."
"Did you swear too?" Brianna spoke quietly, but her eyes were intent on the white-haired figure in the chair.
"No, I didn't swear."
Jocasta's lips, still finely shaped, curved slightly as though amused.
"I was Hector's wife. His oath bound me. Then..."
Uneasy in possession of so much wealth, the conspirators had left the tavern before dawn, bundling the chests in blankets and rags to hide them.
"A pair of travellers rode in as the last of the chests was brought down. It was their coming that saved the innkeeper's life, for it was a lonely spot, and he the only witness to our presence there that night. I think Dougal and Hector would not have thought to do such a thing, but the third man, he meant to dispose of the landlord. I saw it in his eyes and the crouch of his body as he waited near the bottom of the stair, his hand on his dirk. He saw me watching. He smiled at me beneath his mask."
"And did he never unmask, this third man?" Jamie asked.
His ruddy brows drew together as though by sheer concentration he could recreate the scene she saw in her mind's eye and identify the stranger.
She shook her head.
No. I asked myself now and then, when I thought of that night, would I know the man again, did I see him? I thought I would. He was dark, a slender man, but with a strength in him like knife steel. Could I see his eyes again, I would be sure of it. But now...
She shrugged.
Could I ken him by his voice alone? I canna say, so long ago it was. But he wasna by any means an Irishman, this man.
Duncan was still pale and clammy-looking, but he had raised himself on one elbow, listening with deep absorption. Jocasta started a little, as though she'd forgotten his presence.
Ah, no, Adunya. A Scot by his speech. A Highland gentleman.
Duncan and Jamie exchanged glances.
A Mackenzie or a Cameron? Duncan asked softly,
and Jamie nodded.
Or perhaps one of the Grants.
I understood their half-voiced speculations.
There were, had been, a staggeringly complex array of associations and feuds among the Highland clans, and there were many who would not, could not, have cooperated in an undertaking of such importance and secrecy.
Colum Mackenzie had negotiated a close alliance with the Camerons. In fact, Jocasta herself had been part of that alliance. Her marriage to a Cameron chief, the token of it. If Dougal Mackenzie was one of the men who had engineered the receipt of the French gold, and Hector Cameron another, it was odds on that the third man had been someone from one of those clans, or from another trusted by both. Mackenzie, Cameron, or Grant. And if Jocasta hadn't known the man by sight, the odds on his being a Grant improved, for she would have known most high-ranking taxmen of clans Mackenzie or Cameron. But there was no time now to consider such things. The story wasn't finished. The conspirators had separated then, each going by his own way, each with one-third of the French gold. Jocasta had no knowledge of what Dougal Mackenzie or the unknown man had done with their chests. Hector Cameron had put the two chests he brought away into a hole in the floor of his bedroom, an old hiding place made by his father to conceal valuables. Hector meant to leave it there until the prince had reached some place of safety where he could receive the gold and use it for the furtherance of his aims. But Charles Stuart was already in flight and wouldn't find a place to rest for many months. Before he reached his final refuge, disaster intervened. Hector left the gold and me at home and went to join the prince and the army. On the 17th of April, he rode back into the dooryard at sunset, his horse lathered to a froth. He swung down and left the poor beast to a groom while he rushed into the house and bade me pack what valuables I could. The cause was lost, he said, and we must flee or die with the Stuarts. Cameron was wealthy even then, and canny enough to have kept his coach and horses rather than giving them to the Stuart cause. Canny enough, too, not to carry two chests of French gold in his flight. He took 3 bars of the gold from one of the chests and gave them to me. I hid them under the seat of the coach. He and the groom carried the chests awa' to the wood. I didna see where they buried them. It was midday of April the 18th when Hector Cameron boarded his coach with his wife, his groom, his daughter Mona, and 3 bars of French bullion, and headed hell for leather south toward Edinburgh. Sharrock was married to the master of Garth. He declared early for the Stuarts. He was killed at Culloden, though of course we didn't know it then. Clementina was widowed already and living with her sister at Rovo. She took a deep breath, shuddering slightly, unwilling to relive the events she recounted, unable to resist them.
I begged Hector to go to Rovo. It was only 10 miles out of the way. It would have taken no but a few hours. But he wouldn't stop. We could not, he said. Too big a risk to take the time needed to fetch them. Clementina had 2 children. Shunach, the one. Too many people for the coach, he said. It would slow us too much. Not to bring them away, then, I said. Only to warn them. Only to see them once more.
She paused.
I kent where we were bound. We had talked of it, though I didn't ken he had things in such readiness.
Hector Cameron had been a Jacobite, but was also a keen judge of human affairs, and no man to throw his own life after a lost cause. Seeing how matters were falling out and fearing some disaster, he had taken pains to engineer an escape. He had quietly put aside a few bags of clothing and necessities, turned what he could of his property into money, and secretly booked 3 open passages from Edinburgh to the colonies.
"Sometimes I think I cannot blame him," Jocasta said.
She sat bolt upright, the light of the candles gleaming from her hair.
"He thought Shonak wouldna go without her husband, and Clementina wouldna risk her bairns at sea. Perhaps he was right about that. And perhaps it would have made no difference to warn them. But I knew I shouldna see them again."
Her mouth closed, and she swallowed. In any case, Hector had refused to stop, fearing pursuit. Cumberland's troops had converged upon Culloden, but there were English soldiers on the Highland roads, and word of Charles Stuart's defeat was spreading like ripples near the edge of a whirlpool, moving faster and faster in a vortex of danger. As it was, the Camerons were discovered 2 days later near Ochtertyre.
"A wheel came off the coach," Jocasta said with a sigh. "Lord, I can see it now, spinning down the road by itself. The axle tree was broke, and we'd no choice but to camp there by the road, while Hector and the groom made shift to mend it."
Repairs had taken the best part of a day, and Hector had grown more and more edgy as the work went on, his anxiety infecting the rest of the party.
"I didn't ken then what he'd seen at Culloden," Jocasta said. "He kent weel enough that if the English took him, it was all up wi' him. If they didna kill him on the spot, he'd be hanged as a traitor. He was sweating as he worked, and more we fear than with the heat of his labour. But even so..."
Her lips pressed tight for a moment before she went on.
"It was nearly dusk. It was spring. Dusk came early, when they got the wheel back on the coach and everyone got back aboard. The coach had been in a wee hollow when the wheel flew off. The groom urged the horses up a long slope, and just as we reached the crest of the hill, 2 men with muskets stepped out from the shadows into the road ahead."
This ends Disc 25. The Fiery Cross, Disc 26.
It was a company of English soldiers, Cumberland's men. Arriving too late to join in the victory at Culloden, they were inflamed by news of it, but frustrated at not sharing in the battle, and only too ready to wreak what vengeance they could on fleeing Highlanders. Always a quick thinker, Hector had sunk back in the corner of the coach at sight of them, his head bent and a shawl pulled over it, pretending to be an aged crone sunk in sleep. Following his hissed instructions, Jocasta had leaned out of the window, prepared to pose as a respectable lady travelling with her daughter and mother. The soldiers hadn't waited to hear her speech. One yanked open the door of the coach and dragged her out. Mona, panicked, had leapt out after her, trying to pull her mother away from the soldier. Another man had grabbed the girl and dragged her back, so that he stood between Jocasta and the coach.
"Another minute, and they meant to have Granny out on the ground as well. And then they would find the gold, and it would be all up wi' all of us."
A pistol shot startled all of them into momentary immobility. Leaning from the coach's open door, Hector had fired at the soldier holding Mona. But it was dusk, and the light was poor. Perhaps the horses had moved, jostling the coach. The shot struck Mona in the head.
"I ran to her," Jocasta said.
Her voice was hoarse, her throat gone dry and thick.
"I ran to her, but Hector jumped out and seized me. The soldiers were all standing, staring with the shock. He dragged me back into the coach and shouted to the groom to drive. Drive on."
She licked her lips and swallowed once.
"She is dead," he said to me. over and over.